Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. Each winter, EQMM helps the Baker Street Irregulars, the world's oldest Sherlockian society, to celebrate the birthday of Sherlock Holmes. On January 6th, the day fans have determined to be Holmes' birthday, BSI members gather annually in New York City for a gala birthday banquet where they always find at their seats a copy of the current issue of EQMM. As in many past years, this year the Sherlockian content of that special issue, which is on sale now, includes a Sherlock Holmes parody by Terence Faherty. For this episode in our podcast series, the Indianapolis author, who is best known for two series of mystery novels, one starring former seminarian Owen Keene and the other private eye Scott Elliott, has chosen an early case from his series of Holmes parodies. Here is Terence Faherty reading his story, The Engineer's Thumb, from the January-February 2017 issue of EQMM.
Editor's Note. The controversy sparked by the discovery and publication of early drafts of Dr. John H. Watson's immortal Sherlock Holmes stories continues to roil the world of Sherlockian scholarship. In protest, several prominent Sherlockians have moved on to other fields of study, such as The Shroud of Turin and certain films of William Shatner. Others have embraced the new material and the insight it provides into both Holmes the sleuth-hound and Watson the storyteller. It is to satisfy the demands of these inquiring minds that we here publish the earliest known draft of The Engineer's Thumb. Of all the amazing cases which came to the attention of my friend Mr. Sherlock Holmes, only two did so through my agency, that of Vedder Hatcher's thumb and the strange insanity of General Waxbutton, who imagined himself to be a giant cockroach. The latter case has no conceivable literary potential, but Mr. Hatcher's adventure was so dramatic and coincided so closely with Holmes' personal areas of expertise that an official record of it is more than justified. This is especially true in light of the very incomplete and pedestrian treatment the affair received in the newspapers of the day. It was the summer of 89, while I was still recovering from the shock of my marriage, that these events took place. I had returned to private practice, leaving Holmes to his bachelor ways, though I was occasionally able to persuade him to visit my wife and me by offering him a bottomless tankard of his favorite stout, one purveyed exclusively by a pub in our neighborhood. That neighborhood was very near Paddington Station, and I obtained a steady stream of patients through the good offices of a minor station official, whom I had once cured of a mild dermatitis. One morning, I was awakened before 7 by the arrival of this station guard and a second man, a traveler, I concluded from his heavy tweed suit, a deduction of which Holmes would have been proud. The guard, scratching himself a little from old habit, introduced his companion as a recent arrival from the Berkshire region, and then hurried off. "Sorry to rouse you so early, doctor," the stranger said. "I've little enough excuse, in truth." He raised a roughly bandaged hand in explanation. He was a stout, well-built man of around 25 summers, whose strong features were marred by an expression of deep perplexity. A second off note was an odor of rotten eggs that clung to his person. "My name is Vedder Hatcher, and I'm actually a resident of London. I was out of town on business last night. Monkey business," he added with an odd, bubbling chuckle. He checked his laughter by an apparent effort of will. "Perhaps you'd be so good as to examine my thumb." Sitting down, the sufferer unwound his bandage, which I now saw to be a handkerchief, exposing 4 ordinary fingers and the most thoroughly black and blue thumb I had ever seen. I shuddered to look at it, though in my service days I had treated men kicked by army mules. That experience colored my reaction. "Were you trod upon by a horse?" "No," said Hatcher, "struck by a most peculiar mallet. Tell me the worst, doctor. You will certainly lose the nail." He nearly fainted at that, what man would not, and I stimulated him with a brandy and water. I then washed the offended digit and cushioned it with some cotton and antiseptic gauze. "Thank you," he said when I'd finished. "Now I must go to the police, though I doubt they'll understand the affair any better than I do." "Hold on," I said, for I had stimulated myself with a second brandy and water, and I saw the chance for a second referral and a second fee. "If it's a mystery you want solved, I suggest you try my friend Sherlock Holmes." "Would you give me a note of introduction?" "I'll do better than that." I ushered him out quietly so as not to alert my wife, and we were shortly in a hansom bound for Baker Street. Holmes was lounging in his dressing gown, studying the latest cricket scores, as I'd anticipated. At Hatcher's appearance, the detective discreetly refolded his newspaper so that the agony columns were outermost. When he learned that neither his prospective client nor I had breakfasted, he ordered up some Scotch porridge. What arrived was so thick, it could easily have been sliced and fried in the country manner. After poor Hatcher had forced down as much of it as he could, Holmes settled him upon the sofa. "That's right," he said. "Take a load off and tell us all about your remarkable evening. Something to do with very old eggs, was it?" Hatcher sniffed at his lapel. "No," he said, "but I will get to that in due course. To begin with, you should know that I am a hydraulic engineer by training and experience. I recently set up my own office here in the city, perhaps prematurely. I had high hopes for it, though I must admit that business has been slow so far. Yesterday was especially quiet. In fact, I was thinking of leaving early when my clerk announced a visitor, one Colonel Lester Strake. He turned out to be a man built along the lines of a breadstick, his extreme thinness extending even to his face, which was all angles and protruding bones. As soon as my man had left us, Strake began questioning me in a way that made me feel I was back at my university, undergoing an oral examination. "Mr. Hatcher," he said in a German accent, "I have been told that you are a man of considerable competence and discretion. Is that so?" I replied that my diplomas and certificates were on display all about him. "Just so, but are you discreet? Let me speak more plainly. Can you keep a secret?"
"If I promise to keep a secret," I replied, "you can consider it locked in the vault."
"Are you making such a promise now?"
"No, I am simply describing it." The colonel pulled on his face somewhat inexplicably.
"Will you make such a promise now?"
"If you like."
"Now have you made it?"
"No, I've merely stated my readiness to do so." He began to finger a heavy glass paperweight on my desk in a marked manner.
"Please promise me that you will keep secret what I am about to divulge."
"Righto," I said, smiling to myself at the long way this foreigner had taken around the barn. The colonel relaxed visibly.
"Gut, then I require you to travel by train this evening from Paddington to Iford in Berkshire. It is a small place near Reading. The train will drop you there at 11:15. I will take you the final 6 miles to my establishment by carriage."
"It will be midnight by the time we arrive. Can't I drop in tomorrow noonish?"
"No, it must be tonight. To compensate you for the inconvenience, I am willing to pay 50 guineas.
"What exactly do you require of me?"
"Is your office safe from eavesdroppers?"
"Entirely, if I say so myself."
"But are you saying so? Never mind. The situation is this. My partner and I have developed a new pickling process that we are endeavoring to keep secret until it is perfected. We have been successful with gherkins and are currently experimenting with boiled eggs and onions. However, our apparatus for recycling the fermenting brine has developed a fault. We need you to correct it."
"Count on me."
"And remember, mum the word is.
After he'd gone, I began to think the business queer, but then I remembered the 50 guineas. I caught my train at Paddington, changed at Reading, and arrived at Iford a little after 11. The residents could rename the place Eyesore and never be accused of false modesty. Colonel Strake was waiting with a one-horse carriage, completely enclosed, its windows covered by black shades. We did our 6 miles in 30 minutes. All that time the colonel was watching me, like he wanted to start up that secrecy routine again, but didn't quite have the heart. Finally, we stopped so close to the porch of a house that we were practically in the front hall. 2 steps from the carriage, and I actually was in the hall. It was lit by a single lamp, held aloft by a striking woman. Holmes, who had been following the meanderings of a fly with apparent fascination, sat up. Describe her. It would take a poet, Tennyson say, to really do her justice. She was tall, with dark hair worn in corkscrew curls, like you see on a Roman statue. She had the figure of a statue, too, what I could see of it under her rich gown, and skin as pale as marble. It seemed to me she paled a little more when the colonel introduced me and mentioned my business. My employer asked me to wait in a side room for a few minutes. It was a dingy hole, and I began whistling airs from HMS Pinafore to keep up my spirits. I had gotten as far as Little Buttercup when the Lady of the Lamp entered my chamber alone. "I would go," she said, in an accent identical to the colonel's. "Would you?" I said. "Yes, I would go now." "Well, if you must go, have a pleasant night."
"No, you."
"No, you," I returned with a slight bow, for I can be as continental as the next hydraulic engineer.
"Oh,"
she said, and, with a stamp of her tiny foot, she left me. Shortly afterward, my host returned and led me deeper into his odd establishment. It was a house of some size, but the interior had been modified to accommodate the pickling plant, which took up 2 full stories. The lower level consisted of a series of large wooden barrels, whose covered tops were pierced by copper pipes that disappeared upward into the ceiling. One of these casks was open for my inspection, and was completely empty. Colonel Strake explained that the system had been drained and cleaned in anticipation of my coming. When I told him that he had made my job more difficult by removing the liquid, his expression suggested that he would have fingered my paperweight again had it been handy. Then he led me upstairs to the upper deck, as it were, of his contraption. I made my inspection there with the aid of a lantern my host provided. I found a metal trough fed by the aforementioned copper pipes, each of which came up through the floor before bending sharply like a shepherd's crook. The pipes' open ends were directly over the trough, but well below the level of its sides. At once I saw the difficulty, which I confirmed by inspecting the complete run of the pipes through a trap door in the floor, which the colonel opened for me using a lever mounted on the wall. "Airlock," I said with the utmost confidence when the inspection door had been safely closed. "Simple airlock. The excess brine rises through the pipes, empties into the trough, and is sent back to the barrels, correct?"
"Correct," said the German, though this demonstration of my expertise made him strangely uneasy.
"The problem is that any excess air will get caught in the swan's neck curve at the top of each pipe as soon as the level of liquid in the trough rises high enough to seal the pipe's end. The airlock then blocks all movement. Just shorten the pipes by an inch or two to get them well above the trough, and your worries are over."
"So?"
"Absolutely so," I said. I then began ruminating aloud. "The thing I don't understand is where the air came from. Nothing in pickling brine should produce that quantity of gas." I instantly regretted my words, as the colonel's strange and angular face suddenly became far stranger and even more angular. "Understand this," he hissed. Seizing the lever for the trap door, he yanked it sharply. This fiend in human form had noticed that I was standing squarely on the door.
When it opened, I dropped like the proverbial stone. I released my hold on my lantern, grabbing the edge of the opening and so arresting my fall. I had just reached forward with one hand to seize a ring bolt in the floor when I saw Colonel Strake raise a mallet over his head. I tell you, gentlemen, if the devil plays croquet, he uses just such a mallet. Its handle was thin and several feet in length, while the head was a squarish block of wood as big as a family Bible. "A bung starter?" murmured Holmes, with a pleased expression on his face. "A what?" I asked. "A bung starter, Watson, a mallet used to loosen the bung or plug in the side of a cask. Pray proceed, Mr. Hatcher. You've left yourself hanging literally, and Watson and me metaphorically."
"I didn't hang for long, Mr. Holmes. My attacker brought his weapon down on my defenseless thumb like it was the golden spike, and he'd been given the honor of driving it home. I had a sensation of falling, and was then knocked senseless by my landing. I came to when a quantity of foul-smelling liquid poured down on my head. I immediately recognized my peril. By an evil chance, I'd fallen directly into the one barrel whose lid had been removed, and now the pickling brine was cascading down on me. "I am not a gherkin!" I screamed in panic. I was shushed by a voice close above me.
"Quiet! I would climb out quickly."
I recognized the voice and the lamp and the syntax of the beautiful woman I'd spoken to earlier. In addition to her lamp, she held a pail, and I realized that she must have doused me with water to revive me. Unfortunately, it was water that stank of
sulfur, Holmes suggested happily.
"Yes. At the time, I was too busy scrambling out of the cask to care. My rescuer led me to a door that opened onto a garden.
"I would run," she said.
"I will run," I replied, and matched the deed to the words. I had not gone far, however, before the pain in my hand and the sulfur fumes I carried caused me to faint. Imagine my shock, Mr. Holmes, when I awoke some time later and found myself within a stone's throw of the Iford train station. How I came to be magically transported those 6 miles, I cannot say.
"We'll work that out when we're on the ground itself," Holmes said, rising to his feet and rubbing his hands together in anticipation. "To Paddington, gentlemen, after a stop at Scotland Yard to collect a professional. We'll need one before this is over."
Holmes hied us along in cab and train, only breaking stride during our stop in Reading, where he insisted on buying a round of pale ales in the station bar. I mistook this as a surrender to his personal weakness, and the detective sensed and chided me for my unspoken admonition.
"This isn't an indulgence, Watson," he said, holding his glass up to the light. "It's a clue."
"A clue?" I remonstrated. "A clue to what?" Inspector Bradstreet, our policeman fourth, asked. "I've heard of no crime yet, except assault with a mallet and pickling without a license."
"How does counterfeiting grab you?" Holmes asked.
The inspector's eyes gleamed.
"We know there's a gang of coiners at work near London. They've been flooding the city with pewter half-crowns."
I protested. What would coiners want with pipes and barrels? Surely stamping equipment would be more in their line. "Imagine being trapped in a giant press," I said, perhaps unkindly, given Hatcher's presence. "Now that would be an exciting scene."
"A trifle pit in the pendulum, wouldn't you say?" Holmes asked dryly. "Beware of borrowing from Poe, old friend. Once started, it's a difficult habit to break."
Bradstreet shouldered in. "But do you think it's counterfeiting?"
"In a manner of speaking," Holmes replied playfully. "And espionage as well."
"Espionage," I exclaimed. "Aldershot, home of the British Army, is just over the county line in Hampshire. Could the Germans..."
"Drink up, gentlemen," Holmes said, becoming once again the man of action. "They're calling our train."
Iford was a plain little place, and doubtless sleepy most days, but not at this particular noontime. The cause of the excitement was immediately apparent.
To judge by the plume of greasy smoke that hung over it, it seemed the whole village must be burning down.
There's our evidence up in flames, said Bradstreet.
No, Inspector, Hatcher said. The house I visited was 6 miles from Iford.
I thought you'd have tumbled to that by now, sir, the professional replied. They trotted you out 3 miles and back 3 miles to confuse you. When you passed out running, you were almost to the station and safe. Isn't that right, Mr. Holmes?
Quite right, Inspector, Holmes replied. To me, he side-mouthed. I wish I'd thought of that.
You will, Holmes, I said. You will. The inspector's fears proved to be well-founded. Though on the whole, dreary Iford was regrettably intact. What must once have been its largest house was now nothing more than a tumbled mass of fragments, a veritable house of Usher. Its blackened timbers were still licked by brazen tongues of flame, but there could be little doubt that this was the house we sought. The village firemen told us they had been confused by the half-melted pipework they'd encountered and perturbed by one grisly discovery, the clear impression on a charred floorboard of a human thumb. The local constable reported to Bradstreet that witnesses had seen a heavily laden cart making off in the direction of Reading.
Now we'll never inspect the colonel's infernal machine, I said. I think I can show you a duplicate, Holmes consoled me, in design, if not in scale.
Where? Hatcher asked.
In Reading, where we must go in any case in our pursuit of Colonel Lester Strake. That's our return train whistling now, I think.
Once again in Reading, we traveled by cab to 7 Bridges Street, and to the gates of the H&G Simmons Brewery, through which Bradstreet's credentials gained us instant admission. Holmes asked to see the master brewer, and that gentleman, gray-whiskered and resembling in silhouette one of the ubiquitous beer barrels, was presently with us.
Tell me, Holmes said, have you recently introduced any technological innovations?
Why, bless me, sir, so we have, said the brewer, who bore the unfortunate name of Belcher. It's our own improvement on the Burton Union method, which removes excess yeast foam from the fermenting casks. Our secret process recaptures the liquid that we formerly lost with the foam. Would you kindly show us the apparatus? When Belcher hesitated over Holmes' request, Bradstreet added, "Official business." We were shown into the brew house, to a vast room that contained a row of huge casks, overshadowed by ironwork supporting a large trough and enough pipes for a cathedral organ. Hatcher gasped.
It's that fiend's exact arrangement, monstrously grown.
I'm afraid, Holmes informed the brewer, that your security has been breached. An agent from a foreign land has stolen your secret, only pausing long enough in this vicinity to build a working model of your system in order to verify his information by duplicating a batch of your excellent pale ale.
To Bradstreet, Holmes added, I promised you counterfeiting and espionage, did I not, Inspector?
What foreign land? Belcher quavered.
On the evidence of his accent, Germany.
I would suggest a brewer from the Dortmund region, given the similarity of their local product to your own.
Belcher staggered backwards.
Never you mind, Bradstreet told him. I'll have the villain before nightfall. I'll take it from here, Mr. Holmes. No, I insist. It's a matter of straight police work now.
There goes a fat fee, Holmes said sourly as we turned to go. Perhaps even free beer for life. Bradstreet would have done better to have retained Holmes' services. Despite his energetic inquiries, no trace of Colonel Strake or the Lady of the Lamp was ever found. Perhaps anticipating the professional's failure, Holmes regained his good humor by the time he and Hatcher and I were ensconced in a compartment of a London-bound train. When I congratulated the engineer on avenging himself on the German in absentia, since it was almost certainly the lantern Hatcher dropped when he'd fallen through the trapdoor that had fired the house, Holmes laughed.
Good old Watson, always a sucker for the dramatic touch.
Am I wrong about the lantern?
Yes. Unless it came with a time-delay fuse.
Our friend dropped it around 1 this morning, and the house was still aflame at noon. Buckingham Palace wouldn't burn that long. Depend upon it, Colonel Strake set that fire so no one would know what he'd been up to.
It would have worked, too, Hatcher said, if not for you, Mr. Holmes. But tell me, whatever made you think of beer?
He's always thinking of beer, I said. Holmes ignored me. It was that very distinctive cologne you're wearing, Mr. Hatcher.
The stink of sulfur?
Precisely. You may not be aware of it, but our characteristic national beers, the ones in which the hop's flavor has an edge as sharp as a cleaver, were first brewed in locales whose water contains high concentrations of calcium sulfate. This secret ingredient, as it were, was isolated by chemists some years back, and now all breweries whose aquifers are not naturally blessed add calcium sulfate to their water. That lucky bucketful you took in the face contained a goodly portion.
Lucky, Hatcher repeated ruefully. I'm out 50 guineas.
But you've gained something more valuable, Holmes assured him.
Experience, I said. No, not experience, Watson. You can't drink experience.
Holmes again addressed the engineer.
I may have lost my free beer for life, but you have not.
Tell your story in any pub. Display your spatulate thumb, and your subsequent rounds will all be free.
At the thought of that, the detective's face was lit as though by an inner light.
Ah me, he said. Ah me.
The Engineer's Thumb is copyrighted by Terence Faherty. Music for the podcast entitled Mr. Badger was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.